Welcome, everyone. We're going to get started now. Wonderful to see everyone made it through the rain. We have a wonderful program for you. And I'm Eleanor Harriman. I'm in place for John Werner. I work with John at TEDx Beacon Street. Ideas in Action is the host here. That's the parent company of TEDx Beacon Street. And we're doing something. This is actually a very special block within the book festival, Boston Book Festival, because we are doing something that's TEDx-like here. If you notice, there are video cameras in the room. We have three, in fact. This isn't just one. We are kind of doing the professional video. We have a wide shot, we have close-up shots, and we have audience reaction shots, too. So you, the audience, are actually very much part of this experience. We are taping each of the authors' presentations, and they will be put, of course, up on websites, on the Boston Book Festival website, on the TEDx Beacon Street website, and YouTube as well. And the idea here of Ideas in Action is we want these ideas to spread, and you all can be part of that. You can blog and comment about the ones you like. You can send them around to your friends. One of you can be the reason that it gets amplified to thousands of people, frankly, because that's how it works. That's how it happens. So you're very much a part of this. So we're excited to have you here. So this is the first time we've done this. I just want to emphasize that. TEDx Beacon Street has, by the way, 700 talks that have had 100 million views, over 100 million views in total. All right, so we will get started. Are we ready in the back here? Okay, we are ready. Our first author, John Kagg, is the author of the book American Philosophy, A Love Story, which was an NPR Best Book in 2016. And it was a New York Times editor's best choice, or choice rather. He just had a book that came out 2 weeks ago, in fact, called Hiking with Nietzsche, which is the sequel to that other book. It was positively reviewed in The Atlantic and by NPR, and I'm eager to hear what he has to share with us. Thanks.
This is a true story, a real story, as real as these 19-year-old shoes that I hiked the Alps with the first time. This is a story of two philosophical trips, one when I was 19 and then one when I'm 37, 2 years ago. Both of them were in search of Europe's existential bad boy, Friedrich Nietzsche. So most of us know Nietzsche by his bumper sticker slogans, "God is dead," "What doesn't kill you makes you stronger," the Übermensch, this sort of ideal of existential individualism, Promethean individualism. Many young people are drawn to Nietzsche, and I was one of them, drawn to this individualism when I was 19. So how did this journey begin? When I was 19, it began this way. I was in college in central Pennsylvania, very cloistered, small community. I was a junior philosophy major. And at the end of my junior year, I was writing a thesis on Nietzsche, his will to power, and genius and insanity. At the end of that semester, my professor, Douglas Anderson, and the professor who was teaching me Nietzsche at the time, Dan Conway, handed me an unmarked envelope. And in that envelope was $3,000. And they said, "You should go somewhere. You've never been outside of central Pennsylvania. You're studying Nietzsche, and we have a trip set up for you. 9 weeks in Sils Maria, where Nietzsche summered. And we already have the accommodations laid out for you. You're going to stay in the Nietzsche House, which is now a museum, but they had called the curator of the museum, and he was going to let me stay next to Nietzsche's room for 9 weeks. That's what I did. I went there. And when you go in search of Nietzschean transcendence when you're 19 and you're obsessed with the will to power and individualism, sometimes things go a little off the rails. And they did, in a very radical way for me. So, when Nietzsche says God is dead, what he means is that the conventions of our lives, church, state, family, culture, these institutions do not have the same grip on us as individuals as they once did historically. Nietzsche poses a challenge to us. He says, given this looseness now, the fact that God is dead, that we are abandoned only to ourselves, what are we going to do with our lives? What are we going to do with the choices we have? Nietzsche gives us radical freedom. Okay? Now, that sounds good, but Nietzsche knows, like his Danish contemporary Søren Kierkegaard, that radical freedom is often accompanied by great anxiety. And for 9 weeks when I hiked the mountains behind the Nietzsche house, that's what I experienced. It was my first bout with acute anxiety, acute depression, and what turned out to be an acute eating disorder. It didn't go well. I got lost for 3 days in the mountains, wearing these, and wearing basically this. And it turns out, even in the summer, the Alps can be cold. And so I ended up with this, a scar on my right and left ear, which was from frostnip. It didn't go well. So I went back home. Fast forward 17 years. My anxiety, depression, and suicidal ideations had been in some ways contained by a medical cocktail. Okay? And I had managed to get myself into a first marriage, out of a first marriage, into a second marriage, and now I had a 4-year-old daughter with a loving wife, and I was bathing this loving daughter. And she reached up and said, "Papa, what happened to your ear?" And it was this moment where I thought, oh my gosh, maybe Nietzsche should be returned to. Maybe we should see what happens when we go back to him. Because Nietzsche oftentimes is regarded as an adolescent philosopher, one that we sort of approach in our teenage years, but that we grow out of in our maturity. But I think, as I've approached 40, I now think that Nietzsche's Übermensch, this transcendent ideal, is best suited to those people who are cresting middle age, those people who, in fact, need to ask themselves, can I be otherwise? Is my life simply one of mediocrity, stasis, inertia? Am I being dissolved in mere togetherness? And that's why I said, well, Becca, maybe we should go back. And that's what we did. So when I was 37, we went back to Sils Maria. Carol, my wife, Becca, my daughter, me, and Nietzsche. 4 of us. And it turns out that Nietzsche has other lessons other than the will to power and individualism. Nietzsche's central concept in his work is what's known as the eternal return, or the eternal reoccurrence. And the eternal reoccurrence is a thought experiment that Nietzsche gives us, and he says this to us. He says, imagine a demon comes to you in your loneliest of lonelies, and says the following thing to you. Says, would you be willing to live this moment exactly the same? Not once, not twice, not a dozen times, but an infinite number of times. And would that thought, that eternal return, would it elevate your soul or would it crush you? So when I was 19, I thought that the only way of responding to the eternal return was through the will to power. This idea that what human beings find most meaningful is the exercising of a great will. These moments where an individual can show him or herself, right? These were the moments that we would be willing to live over. When I talk to my 19-year-old students today, I say, what moments would you be willing to live over? And usually my 19-year-old men raise their hand. They say, when I hit that home run, when I was exercising that will to power. Right? But it turns out that 30 and 40 and 50-year-old life does not merely consist in wills to power or in the will to power. It consists in times when our will to power fails us, or when we exercise it in dangerous or destructive ways, when we hurt ourselves or hurt others. Nietzsche knows that. In fact, later in his life, Nietzsche was not strong, but deeply vulnerable. And if anything, hiking with Nietzsche is the tale of two stories, a tale of Nietzsche at 19, this individualism, and then something different when you read Nietzsche again. Now, it turns out that the eternal return can be satisfied in another way, apart from the will to power. The will to power is part of it, but so too is what Nietzsche calls the amor fati. Now, the amor fati, what he says, is the love of fate. He says that not only do we have to exercise our will, but we have to realize that life actually consists, for the most part, of moments when we feel vulnerable, hurt, when we fail ourselves and when we fail others. And what I found out is that in terms of parenting, there are plenty of those moments. Okay? So in light of that fact, you have to cultivate, Nietzsche says, the love of fate. That we have to love not only those moments that are most glorious about us, but those moments that are most humiliating, embarrassing, despicable. The types of moments where somebody says, yeah, I've had an eating disorder for 20 years, where I own up to it. Now, Nietzsche, I think, would like us to own up to our lives. Nietzsche says the following to us. He says, I value philosophers only to the extent that they can be models for our lives. I've often wondered, if that's the case, how could he be a model, right? He didn't have any very functional relationships. He had a very vexed relationship with his family. He had a tragic end that most people would say is one of insanity. But Nietzsche does do something for us, and in fact does something for us as our hair turns gray. He asks us to own up to our lives. That the point of life is not to get to the top of the mountain, as I thought it was at 19, and as I thought, oh, you get there only by yourself, but rather perhaps to walk with others, to slip with others, to own up to the ways that we slip and fall and get muddy. Maybe that's the point of life. And Nietzsche says, if that is the point of life, perhaps that's where, in his words, we become who we are. Now, in the end, this second rendering of Nietzsche, you discover something, or I discovered something, that becoming who you are has nothing to do with discovering a who that you find out there somewhere in the Alps. It happens right here, in the process of becoming, in the sort of the shit of things. It's not somewhere else. That's the first thing. Second, becoming who you are, there is no enduring you that you're supposed to become. That's the second. And then the R is not enduring for all times. It is in the process of flux. It is in the process of change that we find ourselves. And maybe becoming who you are is a process of losing and finding yourself again. That is a good hope when you turn 40. Okay, maybe that's the process of the Übermensch. Maybe becoming who you are involves getting over who you think you should be, the preconceived notions of who you think you should be. So I will stop there, and I'd actually like lots of questions, because what I've found in talking about Friedrich Nietzsche is everybody has an idea about who Nietzsche is, or about their Nietzsche, which I think is great. So I'd like to take some questions from the floor. I think we have 5 minutes. Thank you. And I'd ask to come to the mic. If you can line up at the mic, that would be fantastic.
First, thank you. Beyond your work and signing up for a class or something, what do you consider to be the best avenue to open up more about Nietzsche? Like, which of his writings or what other way do you consider is the best way to learn more?
To get into it. Yeah, to get into it. So Julian Young is a professor of philosophy, and he wrote what's called the philosophical autobiography of Friedrich Nietzsche. And what Young does is a very nice job of fleshing out Nietzsche's life through the letters. Mm-hmm. I would also recommend Sue Prideaux's new book, I Am Dynamite, which is an outstanding sort of comprehensive biography that comes out in the U.S. on October 30th.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm not that familiar with Nietzsche. Could you give me a little background about where he was born and in what year?
Absolutely. So, 1844, and Nietzsche, he was brought up in a strict Lutheran family, so was I, and his father died when he was four. Mine abandoned my family when I was four. And he grew up as a good little parish boy. So the man who later would say that God is dead, rebelled against Christianity, actually started up wed to Christianity in a very real way. So Nietzsche's iconoclasm, the idea that he runs against the grain, started in 1872 with the birth of tragedy. And Nietzsche is pushing us to understand what is called philology, which is the study of ancient languages. He was a study of ancient Greece, Greek. He's asking us to understand how ancient languages can affect our lives. So as opposed to trying to figure out what ancient languages mean back there, he, as opposed to his other scholars, were interested in changing our life on the basis of these ancient texts. One of these ancient texts, or rather one theme in these ancient texts, is that life needs to be a balance between what he called the Apollonian and the Dionysian. The Apollonian being this call to order, the Dionysian being this call to passion or impulse. And what Nietzsche oftentimes pushes in his later philosophy is that modern life has emphasized to our detriment the Apollonian, this order, this absolute order, emphasize that rather than the Dionysian, this passion, this emotional way of living. So that gives you a little sense of probably what he's responding to in terms of his early life, but then also one of the important themes, the Apollonian and Dionysian in his work. That's a great question, though. Come on, I think we have time for maybe one or two more. Just one more.
Last one. You mentioned this, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. There's even a pop song. It's like you hear it so often. And I just wonder, what's your take on how it's being interpreted in the popular culture as opposed to what Nietzsche actually meant by that? And also, I guess, kind of your own experience, what didn't kill you brought you back and made you stronger. So I don't know if you feel that way or if that's true.
That's
or not.
A wonderful question. So I think this idea, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, a lot of my very muscular 19-year-old men in my classes love this. They're like, let's go to the gym. We can do this. We can be Nietzscheans. And I think what Nietzsche is emphasizing, however, is in times of great sickness, in times of great frailty, we actually discover who we are. And in fact, those times of frailty, he says, I am indebted most to the times of my great sickness because they have made me who I am. And I think owning up to those moments where we're on the cusp of death, for example, are moments in which we can find ourselves, which is a different way than saying, let's just go to the gym and exercise our will to power. So I think that's the standard notion. But I think that there's a softer, more vulnerable side to Nietzsche that I'd encourage you folks to pursue. So thanks.
Touch the shoes. Okay, that was wonderful. Are you ready back there? Good. Okay. Next, we have Rachel Slade. It's another fascinating story for you. Rachel Slade wrote Into the Raging Sea. This book was the book of the summer by the New York Times Book Review. It also received rave reviews from actually dozens of media outlets. Importantly, very importantly to her, this book has been embraced and actually put on the curriculum by the maritime community. So it's basically been in some ways certified and adopted. So this will be really a treat, Rachel.
I'm on. So what is the one thing on which all of modern life depends? If you're of a certain age, you might be thinking the internet. And that's a great answer in some ways. But the internet is designed to do one thing really well, and that's spread around information. And ultimately, as we know from what we've discovered from Facebook and other revelations by, for example, Jaron Lanier, in fact, the internet is really great at getting us to buy things. And the algorithms are really great also at accumulating our data also to get us to buy things. So everything on the internet is engineered to make sure that we make purchases. Okay, so ultimately, I would argue that life as we know it does not depend on the internet, but in fact, on the cheap and efficient movement of goods across oceans. So yes, I'm talking about shipping. We don't think a lot about shipping. It's an invisible industry to many of us. You may not know that Boston gets one or two ships a week. Most of our goods actually come through New York, which has five major ports. And then our goods get trucked up to here, along 95. But we do know that when the supply is disrupted, there is an instant change in how we work and how we live. And we discovered that And we discovered that last year after Hurricane Maria devastated the island of Puerto Rico. It destroyed Puerto Rico's infrastructure, but it also, most importantly, disrupted the port. That meant that ships couldn't get in. And almost immediately, the shelves throughout Puerto Rico were bare. There was no milk, no fruit, no paper towels. The medical supplies dwindled, and we now know that more than 1,000 people died for lack of resources. A black market struck up to make sure that people got goods. Puerto Ricans depend on a constant supply of ships, and without the ships, modern life ceases to exist. Thank you. Okay. America is an island, too. Now, you may say, what do you mean by that? I want you to look around and just think for a minute. What are you wearing? Think about the clothes. Think about your shoes. Think about the phone in your pocket. Think about the truck or the car or the train or the bicycle that brought you here today. Everything that you touch, more than 90%, spent some time on a container ship. Think about the stacks of T-shirts at Uniqlo or H&M. All of these things, the steel and glass and the buildings that are going up all around the city, came here by container ship. Shipping is the engine that drives the global economy, and I knew none of this until El Faro. It was a 790-foot American container ship. It was the size of the Hancock Building, if you laid her on her side. And it went down 3 years ago, killing 33 Americans. And when it went down, there was an enormous media show. And then we got to see firsthand an inside look at this typically invisible industry. The ship was built in 1974 during Vietnam War before the internet, before cell phones, before containerization. And she had been modified many times and lengthened. But in spite of that, she still carried her ancient lifeboats, similar to those carried on the Titanic. On September 28, 2015, the El Faro was docked in Jacksonville, Florida, and was being loaded by all the things that Puerto Ricans would need for their daily lives. It was one of twice weekly runs between Jacksonville and Puerto Rico. $25 million worth of goods went on the ship that day, including new cars and trucks and refrigerated trailers filled with frozen chicken and office supplies and clothes and children's toys and pet food. Everything the shelves of Walmart and Targets throughout the island would need. And like all container ships around the world, she was crewed by very few people. Just 28 Americans aboard, from Florida and from Maine mostly, and five gentlemen who were doing repairs while she was at sea, because a ship in port is a ship losing money. So here's a 40-year-old ship in massive disrepair, and they're fixing it while she's at sea. The youngest person aboard was 23 years old. His name was Dylan Mecklen. And this was his first job out of Maine Maritime Academy, his first job on a ship, his first week working. The captain was Michael Davidson, a Portland native, 53 years old, and a Maine Maritime graduate. He had two daughters in college and a wife, and he had worked on ships for more than three decades, which meant he spent 15 solid years at sea. As the ship was loading, there was a storm brewing off in the Atlantic. It was moving west toward the Caribbean. But the National Hurricane Center was having trouble predicting where the storm would go and how big it would get. They studied their models and made a call. The storm would go north toward the North Carolina coast, and it would dissipate. But some of their models told a vastly different story. One of the models said that this storm would continue to go southwest and escalate into a major hurricane. And because there was uncertainty among the forecasters, they issued supplemental reports on top of their every 6-hour reports. And in those supplemental reports, they explained their reasoning and they explained their level of uncertainty. But the ship's captain needed clear information to make a decision. The other thing affecting their uncertainty was climate change. Heat is the engine that drives hurricanes. And in that area, at that time of year, the ocean was 2 degrees warmer than it had ever been. And even more compelling, the depth of the heat in the ocean was deeper than it had ever been. And we have now seen the result of that. The phenomenon is that hurricanes feast in place on the heat. They don't move, or they move very slowly, and they become powerful, compact storms. And this is exactly what we saw this week with Hurricane Michael, which upgraded very quickly to Category 4 hurricane and then sat there, destroying the coast of Florida. Uncertainty is very difficult to communicate in the digital age. We have Google Maps and we have Waze, and they give us the precise time that we're going to arrive. And in fact, we may never get there. But the technology presents one possible outcome as fact. There is no room for uncertainty in modern life. So Michael Davidson checked the weather because he wanted to know, should he sail his normal route, a straight diagonal line southwest from the coast of Florida out into the Atlantic to San Juan, or go south, due south, on the lee side of the Bahamas and Cuba to avoid a possible storm. He checked the weather and sealed his fate. But there were other factors on his mind. The man didn't want to lose his job. He had played it safe a few weeks before. There was a tropical storm. He took the southern route. He arrived late. It cost money, because it was the longer way. It also cost tens of thousands of dollars in fuel. Maybe the shipping company got angry. We'll never know. And there was more. Davidson had been passed over for a promotion to the new ships that the company was building, and he didn't know why. Why a faithful, careful mariner who had avoided trouble for so many years had not been considered qualified to master the new ships, because his current ship, the El Faro, was 40 years old and was certain to be scrapped soon. And once it was scrapped, Davidson would be out of a job. How long until he found another? Captains make good money. American captains make up to $200,000 a year. But the American fleet is tiny. It's only 3% of the global fleet. Competition for officer jobs is fierce, and someone's always waiting in the wings to bump you off, to take your place. Captains sometimes sail at lower ranks because they can't get jobs, so they'll sail as a chief mate or second mate or third mate, just so that they can work. And they take a tremendous pay cut. And Davidson couldn't afford to do that. On that day, September 28th, as she was loading up, there was somebody else watching the weather, and that was Charlie Baird. Charlie Baird had just walked off El Faro a week before. He had been shipping out like Davidson for 30 years. He was also from Portland, Maine, and he lived up there. And he was off duty at his home watching the Weather Channel, because what do mariners do when they're off duty? They watch the weather. Mariners live and die by the weather. And even if they live in landlocked Arizona, they can tell you what's happening in the middle of the Atlantic. So Charlie was the one who convinced Davidson to take the safe route a few weeks before. And he knew how hard it had been to convince his captain to go that way. Charlie split his second mate job with Danielle Randolph, 33 years old, from Maine. She was relatively new, she was young, and he knew that she probably would not stand up to the captain. Charlie sat on his sofa in his bathrobe watching that Weather Channel, and what he saw about Tropical Storm Joaquin made him really worried. And then he did something that he has never done before. He picked up the phone and he texted Captain Michael Davidson. He can't to this day tell me why. And he said, there's a storm brewing and there are channels, he reminded him, that run east-west from the Atlantic to the Caribbean so that you can find a safe route if you feel yourself trapped up against the Bahamas by the hurricane. A few hours later, Davidson said they'd be fine. The storm would go north, the ship would go south, and they'd shoot under it and arrive in Puerto Rico. But Charlie was worried. He knew people on the ship. He knew them all. He had sailed with many of them for years. He cared about them. And he knew the ship like the back of his hand, and he knew her vulnerabilities. And next morning, he was back on that sofa watching the Weather Channel, and he also figured out how to track El Faro. All ships have a GPS system, and you can actually go online and track any ship around the world. And he saw that the Hurricane Joaquin had been upgraded to a Category 3 hurricane. And all day he watched it into the night, and the next morning he woke up. Joaquin was a Category 4 storm. 120 mile per hour winds, 30 foot seas. We know the horror of those storms. We've seen it. We've seen the photos of Puerto Rico, houses destroyed, trees pulled up from their roots, boats launched deep inland. In that wind, you can't stand up. You'll be blown backward and thrown into a somersault. Charlie checked the location of El Faro, and it was right there at the eye of the storm. He refreshed his GPS throughout the day, but the position of El Faro never changed. At 7:10 that morning, Captain Michael Davidson made an emergency call via satellite to the call center, and I'm going to play you that conversation. It's not easy to listen to. In it, he asks for a QI, a qualified individual, the captain on shore who was responsible for the safety of the ship. He says that there was a hull breach. That means a hole in the ship that allowed water to come in. He said that a scuttle blew open. That's a hatch on the main deck of the ship, allowing water to come in. They lost propulsion. He says they have a heavy list or lean. And he says the clock is ticking. So, Eric, thank you.
I just need your name, please.
Yes, ma'am. My name is Michael Davidson. Michael C. Davidson.
Your rank?
Ship's master.
Okay, thank you. Ship's name?
El Faro.
Spell that? E-L?
Oh, man. The clock is ticking. Can I please speak with a QI? El Faro, Echo Lima, Space, Foxtrot, Alpha, Romeo, Oscar, El Faro. What's your position? Okay.
Okay, in case I lose you, sir, what is your phone number, please? Hi, thank you for waiting. Just really briefly, what is the problem you're having?
I have a marine emergency, and I would like to speak to a QI. We had a hull breach. A scuttle blew open during a storm. We have water down in three holds with a heavy lift. We've lost the main
emergency unit. I just need your name, please.
The engineers cannot get it going. Can I speak with a QI? Yes, ma'am. My name is Michael Davidson.
The Coast Guard launched a massive search and rescue. They sent him helicopters, planes, and cutters fighting Joaquin, searching for a ship at first, and then as Joaquin cleared, searching for survivors. They found nothing. A life ring, debris field, oil slick. The ship was gone. And this is where my book begins. 33 men and women lost, the worst American maritime disaster in 35 years. A joint investigation between the Coast Guard and National Transportation Safety Board was the largest in history. They spent $3 million in 11 months trying to locate the ship 3 miles down on the ocean floor. And finally, they were able to retrieve the black box. And on that black box was 26 hours of recordings of conversations on the bridge of the ship leading up to the accident. The black box told us an intimate detail of life on a doomed ship, the controlled panic, the exhaustion and fear, hope, and the final hours. Because this tragedy is so well documented, this is a sea story unlike any other. My book uses the actual words of the seafarers to describe what happened. It goes deep into the investigation and the search for the ship. But most importantly, the tragedy tells us about the real cost of modern life as we know it. Our constant demand for cheap goods and cheap transportation keeps 100,000 ships traveling around the world at any given moment. Ships just like El Faro, burning heavy fuel oil, together creating as much pollution as the country of Germany. Our packages arrive. We take what's ours and throw away the box. But now, through this important story, we know a little more about the incredible risks that our mariners take to drive the global economy. Thank you. Maybe just one question, or okay. I'm sorry, I know I went a little bit over, so. Okay, thank you very much. That was great.
All right, wonderful. We have our last author, Sachin Panda. Sachin Panda is from the Salk Institute. He has some really interesting research that he's done and published in a book called The Circadian Code. This research is about circadian disorders and interesting interventions that any of you could do in your life that could improve wellness. Well, I don't want to take away from the whole story, but I was fascinated. Anyway, can improve your energy, wellness, and weight, and all sorts of things. So really, I think you'll enjoy this a lot, Sachin.
Thank you. Just imagine, if a baby was born in the year 1900, then he or she lived only to the age of 45. And now in 2018, when someone is born, she or he is expected to live up to 80 years of age. How do you think this miracle happened in just 100 years? So the answer lies in this simple theory, that was the germ theory of disease. That meant 100 years ago, it was mostly infectious diseases that are caused by pathogens that killed people. So sanitation, vaccination, and antibiotics saved life and doubled our human lifespan. So living long life is not same as living long, healthy life, because we spend nearly half of our life fighting chronic illnesses like obesity, diabetes, fatty liver disease, hypertension, and so on. Although there are some medications for all of these diseases, they don't make us healthy. So taking meds is not same as being healthy. So then the question is there a simple concept that explains why we get sick? Or can we have simple formula to stay healthy? And I argue that the new science of circadian rhythm holds the key. The circadian rhythm literally means 24 hours cycle that our body goes through. And all of you can easily imagine one simple rhythm that we go through, that sleep-wake cycle. Almost all of us, if you're lucky enough to go to bed around 10 o'clock, then our deep sleep happens around 2 or 4 in the morning. But there is more than that. Anticipating waking up, our body slowly begins to warm up before dawn. And as we wake up, our sleep hormone melatonin goes down, our wake hormone cortisols begin to rise, and our body can better digest food during daytime. And then our brain performs well around middle of the day, and our muscles perform well in the afternoon. And as the evening rolls in, and melatonin begins to rise, body cools down, and then we go back to sleep. So these rhythms happen on a daily basis. And these rhythms that tell us when to eat, when to sleep, and when to be physically active keep the balance between brain and body, and we stay healthy. So our ancestors didn't have all these chronic diseases because throughout the day they had access to bright daylight, and in the evening there was a lot of darkness, nothing to do, so they had good night of sleep for at least 7 hours every single night. And then during daytime, they had to work hard to make just enough food, and all that food was eaten during daytime. So these nice rhythms in eating, fasting, light, dark, kept them healthy. But now imagine, our modern life is very different. We spend almost the entire 24 hours inside dimly lit room like this. And then at nighttime, we don't sleep enough. We barely sleep for 5 to 7 hours, maybe a few days in a week. And in the daytime, there is very little opportunity to be physically active. And we keep on eating. So all these three break our circadian rhythms. And when our rhythms are broken only for 2 or 3 days, it doesn't matter whether you're a baby, kid, teenager, adult, or older adults. You feel horrible. You feel sleepy, bloated, low energy, and foggy. And if it continues for weeks, months, or years, then that brings us close to many chronic diseases like obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, etc. So then, how does this system work, and what can we do about it? So just like you can imagine that we have a circadian clock or a 24-hour clock in our brain that tells us when to sleep or when to wake up, what is really surprising discovery over the last 20 years is almost every organ in our body, even every cell in our body, has its own circadian clock. And these clocks work together to produce daily rhythms in physiology, metabolism, and everything. And what is interesting is almost every hormone in our body, every brain chemical, and even every gene has a timing instruction to it. So how is this clock connected to the outside world? So what we figured out is light that's sent through the eye resets our clock so that when we move from one time zone to another time zone, or when the daylight saving time changes, then we can readjust to the new season or the new time zone. But this light sensor was very special because, one, sensing light is not same as seeing. So that means even if we lose millions of cells in our eye that helps us to see, we'll still have few thousand neurons or cells. These are special circadian light-sensing neurons that are directly connected to our brain. Second, they're actually less sensitive to light. You need a lot of bright light to fully activate this circadian light-sensing. And number three, they're more sensitive to daylight that's rich in blue light, and they're almost blind to orange light that comes from candlelight and firelight. So now, in this context, what we know, if we go back to our ancestors, the ancestors had very little access to light, and that was mostly candlelight and firelight at night. So in that way, our brain was thinking that it's dark outside, the melatonin level was rising, and people were sleeping well. And in the daytime, as they went outside, there was bright light. Even today, in this rainy day outside, there's 10,000 lux of light, and now we are sitting here with 100 lux of light. So as we go outside, our circadian light sensors get activated. Our circadian clock gets nicely synchronized. As sleep hormone goes down, depression goes down, and alertness and happiness comes up. But now, as we spend most of our time in indoor, in the evening, bright light and bright screen keeps our circadian light sensors active. Our brain gets confused. We get very little sleep. And during daytime, we spend most of our daytime indoors. That's not enough light to fully activate this circadian light sensing. So we feel more depressed and we are low. So if it continues for several weeks or months, then we get predisposed to depression, anxiety, PTSD, etc. And this is very important, particularly for young children, because circadian disruption in young children whose brains are just developing can make them prone to diseases like ADHD and autism that lives with them for the rest of their life. So this very simple idea or knowledge about how light, which color of light affects our brain, has huge potential. Now we can combine this biology with technology, so you can imagine the future where smart homes, smart hospitals, and smart classrooms can sense the circadian rhythm in our body and can really brighten up the room with blue light when you are awake or when you are working. At nighttime, they'll slowly dim down to orange light to help us better sleep. So in that way, the circadian lighting can promote better learning and brain development in children, can increase productivity, and can even improve healing among older adults. But light is not the only thing that affects our clock. When light at night keeps us wide awake, our mouth is also wide open because we keep on eating. So a few years ago, we figured out that eating at the wrong time takes over the entire system and our body gets completely confused and the balance in metabolism breaks down, and we get more prone to disease. So this idea that even a healthy food at the wrong time can be junk was very provocative. So we wanted to test this idea that timing makes food healthy or junk. And we went back to what we do best, back to the lab, and brought some mice. We had two identical groups of mice, born to the same mother, in the same room, had exactly the same microbiome, and ate the same exact food every single day from the same type of food. So the only difference was when they ate. The first group of mice are nocturnal, they were allowed to eat whenever they wanted, day or night. And the second group of mice was trained to eat exactly the same number of calories from the same food only at night time between, say, 8 to 12 hours. And we continued this experiment for weeks, even up to a year. And the surprising thing was, mice that ate randomly anytime, they became obese, they had diabetes, they had cardiovascular disease, and even they were more prone to cancer. Whereas the second group of mice that ate only within 8 to 12 hours were completely healthy. But what is more surprising is, if we take the sick mice and train them to eat only for 8 to 10 hours, then within few weeks, they also become healthy. So this was an earth-shattering, really eureka moment for two things. One, there is not even a single drug ever developed that works even in mice to reverse all this disease. Second, 100 years of nutrition science has told us what and how much we eat matters. But now we figured out that when we eat is as important as what and how much we eat. So to test this new idea, we went back to lab and then developed a new app. And anyone, anywhere in the world can go to this website, mycircadianclock.org, sign up for the study, download an app, and then record when they eat. What we found was truly surprising. Although people say, most people say they eat all their meals within 12 hours, what we found is even people who have an 8-to-5 job, 50% of them eat for 15 hours or longer. So that means if the first calorie of the day happens at 6 a.m. in the morning, then the last sip of wine, milk, or whatever it is happens at 9 o'clock at night or later. So then we wanted to see whether we can tell these people to eat everything that they want within 10 hours. Can they change their behavior? And they did. And not only that, they liked it. After 2 or 3 weeks of struggling, they liked it because it gave them much better sleep at night, and they feel more energetic throughout the day. And within 3 to 4 months, they lost a good amount of body weight. They felt more energetic, they were more active, they reduced their inflammation. And over the last 2 years, thousands of people have signed up for our study. And there are also independent studies coming out from different labs. And what they're telling us is, yes, when people do this, what we call time-restricted eating, then they can reverse many of their diseases. So now, how can we combine all of this information into something that can be practiced? So there are 5 different things. One, try to be in bed for at least 8 hours to get 7 hours of sleep. In the morning, try not to eat for at least an hour because that's when the sleep hormones are going down, the wake-up hormones are coming up. And then try to eat 8, 10, 11, or maximum up to 12 hours. And again, give yourself 2 to 3 hours break before going to bed. No food and dim light. And then during daytime, step outside at least for 30 minutes. Get bright light. That's the best antidepressant, and it's free. You just have to walk outside. So now, if you tell me, well, that's too much, what is only one thing that I can do? Then just try to eat only for 10 hours. Anyone from 2-year-old to 100-year-old can do this. Try to eat for 10 hours, maximum 12 hours. And what we are beginning to see is this can take care of a lot of disease and can give us the long, healthy life that all of us deserve. Thank you. Okay. Maybe one or two questions, yeah?
Better in the morning or evening?
So since you are not doing enough exercise, exercise at any time is good. The morning exercise is good in one sense. When you exercise with low glycogen, then it's good for building your muscle. Exercise is good in the afternoon because that's when our insulin doesn't work very well, but doing some exercise in the evening actually helps us to absorb more glucose. In the middle of the day, when you are checking our emails and doing all this stuff, we forget to breathe. So we have email apnea. Getting outside and doing some exercise will give us that oxygen back.
How about caffeine?
Yes, caffeine. That's a big thing. We always ask people, try to bring your caffeine within that 10 hours. But there are 3 exceptions. One, if you're a shift worker, working all night shift, getting up and then coming home in the morning, sleep deprived. It's better to be caffeinated than to drive sleepy. Number two, if you're working like a TV station where you have to be alert, your job is on the line, coffee is okay. And number three, if coffee is the only thing in the life that you really love, we don't want to take away that love. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Great. Yeah, awesome. Okay, so one little factoid before I tell you about the books, and that is Sachin's book and received, in 72 hours, it was the most emailed New York Times article when it was reviewed by the New York Times. And in the last 10 months, his press releases about his research have had 500 million views. So this is a popular topic. Okay, you can buy books in the back here, and then there's an author signing. The authors will sign your books in around the corner back there. Thank you all very much. Great program.